This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is author Emma Maris. Since 2004, Emma has written for the science journal Nature on ecology, conservation, biology, and other topics. A Seattle native, her articles also have appeared in Wired, the Christian Science Monitor, and Conservation. Emma Maris is here today to tell us about her newly published book, Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. Welcome, Emma.
Hi, great to be here.
What led you to write your book, Rambunctious Garden? What is the goal?
Well, I was covering ecology for Nature for a long time, and I started noticing that there was a real shift going on in the field, that there were some changes in the way that everybody was looking at nature. Also, similar shifts in conservation biology, the sort of more applied field. So I got really excited about this sort of paradigm shift, and I started to obsess over it a little bit, and eventually I decided that my obsession warranted a book because I wanted to share the information with the rest of the world.
Why the title Rambunctious Garden?
So it's sort of supposed to capture two ideas. One idea is it's supposed to describe the whole Earth. One thing I write about in the book is sort of accepting the scope of our influence as a species. We humans have done so much to this planet. We've changed the climate, we've moved species around, we've changed the way the land is organized. We have to sort of really come to terms with and accept that we're in control of almost all of these ecosystems. So in that way, the Earth has become a little bit like a garden, less so than, say, a wilderness. But just because it's a garden run by humans doesn't mean that it has to be sterile or formal or boring. It can still have this kind of rambunctious, exotic, thriving life in it. So that's one way to look at it. The other way is that it can describe your own home garden. I'm hoping that in the future we'll see a bit of a shift and people's own gardens will become more rambunctious as they invite more nature in and sort of let things get a little more wild and feral. So it's meant to work both ways.
In your book, you point out that much of conservation has been focused on protecting pristine nature. What has been the definition of pristine nature?
I think that, especially in North America and even more so in the West, there's been this long time obsession with pristine wilderness. The idea is that when Europeans got to North America, what they saw was this sort of virgin, untouched, pristine wilderness. And that this is what is valuable, and this is what we should be protecting and trying to recreate in restoration projects. But there's a lot of problems with this idea, and the main problem is just that we're learning more and more about the huge changes that prehistoric and pre-European people made to the landscape. When Columbus stepped up the boat, he wasn't looking at some sort of wilderness, he was looking at a thoroughly humanized landscape that had been shaped by generations of people living here. Burning and farming and making land change and even driving animals extinct in the deeper past.
In what ways and to what extent have humans altered nature historically? You've alluded to that, but would you go into more detail?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and it isn't just North America, too. I mean, 13,000 years ago or so in North America, there was this huge extinction pulse of all these gigantic animals like ground sloths and cheetahs and lions. We had all these fantastic beasts here, and now they're all gone. And science is really coming around to the view that they're gone because humans killed them off. So North America is really a much changed place from what it would have been had no humans ever crossed over. Similarly with Australia, except that happened 50,000 years ago when people first got there, there was a big extinction pulse of all the major, really large animals. So all around the world, wherever humans showed up from the sort of core area of Africa and Eurasia, there would be this sort of burst of extinctions. In New Zealand, people didn't get there until 500 years ago or so. And then the moa, gigantic, fantastic bird that's like 12 feet tall, went poof, sort of overnight in like one generation. So they're the extinctions. But then there's also things that happen in more recent times. Massive land clearing for agriculture changes the climate. Massive burning turns forests into prairies. Then you'll have something like the Black Death and everybody will die off and then the forests will come back and we can actually read that in signature in ice cores, sort of atmospheric concentrations. So we've actually been changing the climate even way before the Industrial Revolution. But of course, since then, things have sped up considerably. Now what we have is a planet where every centimeter of the Earth has been changed either by the introduction of a new species, the change in how the land is used, or climate change. I mean, even a place that no one has ever visited or seen is now warmer and has more carbon dioxide than it did 300 years ago.
You point out in your book that it is often assumed incorrectly that indigenous people didn't affect the land. How much did indigenous people affect the land compared to later on?
Well, it's interesting to try to compare it in sort of scope. You could kind of drive yourself crazy trying to figure out who's done more, because while the changes that sort of modern colonial man has done to the earth are really obvious and all around us, those extinctions were huge, you know. There was sort of an ecological ripple effect that came out from those extinctions. So where we used to have large grasslands, then forests would come, and tree composition mixes would change over time. And there's some evidence that those ripple effects are still playing out. So that even if we had never done anything except kill off the megafauna, as they're called, we would still be seeing the sort of gradual unfolding of that event. On the other hand, modern climate change is really drastic and unprecedented in speed. So I think there's an argument to be made that modern humans win the crown for the biggest adjusters of Earth. But regardless of who you're going to say did the most changing, the sort of bottom line, I think, is that we've changed it, and to a point where we're not able to go back.
Would you comment on the assumption that native or pristine ecosystems are superior to ecosystems that have been changed by human activity?
So because of all this new information about how much ecosystems have changed before sort of when, you know, European colonizers got there, the idea that these baselines were somehow naturally correct becomes a little more confusing. Now they're really just pegged to this accident of history of when one group moved in on top of another group, and not to some sort of correct or naturally inherent property of these ecosystems. So one impulse you might have is to try to go further back before any human influence, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. But the problem with that is that ecosystems change by themselves anyway, all the time in the background. The glaciers come move in, the glaciers move out, the sort of species compositions remix and move around. So in North America, if you try to go back before any people, you end up with pretty much ice. So there's no one natural state for any one place. And the more obsessed we become with these historical baselines that we consider to be natural, the more we're limited in what we can do. If we have a strict rule that only native species are allowed, then we might, for example, spend a lot of money trying to rip out exotic species that aren't actually doing that much harm. Or we might not be able to move a species that's at risk because of climate change because we're worried about moving it outside of its historical range. So as the Earth changes and in response to what we've done to it, this sort of historical fidelity can become a straitjacket that limits what we're able to do to try to help nature adapt.
You point out in your book that ecologists have avoided studying areas with considerable human influence. Why is this the case?
Part of it is just historical about how the field of ecology initially differentiated itself from other fields. You know, they sort of staked out this territory of human history. It was natural history. Part of it, though, is also that they've been influenced by this cultural value system that nature is always superior when there's no people in it, that nature with men, women messing around in it isn't really the authentic thing. So there's sort of a cultural norm in ecology that you go off and you find some place that's as pristine as possible to be your study site. And as a result, we have tons of information about how these so-called intact ecosystems operate, but much less information about how ecosystems that are right next door to humankind or ecosystems that are heavily invaded or ecosystems that have been changed a lot operate. And yet those kind of more changed, more dynamic ecosystems are becoming the majority of, on the planet. So we have a lot of information about these tiny little museum piece areas, but not a lot of information about the rest of the world.
What do we lose if the areas with human influence are neglected?
Well, I think most crucially what we lose is a sense of their value, such that anybody can just come up and say, well, look at this forest. It's filled with all these exotic species from Australia and Brazil, and so it's just trash. So we're just going to pave it over and turn it into a mall. If we don't see that these places are natural spaces, then we can't hold on to them in the face of development. And yet they are. They sequester carbon. They have sometimes very high species richness, these sort of more novel ecosystems mixed up. They can be very beautiful. You can go camping in them and hunting and fishing, and they can do all this stuff for us. They have all this value. And if we're blind to it, then we could just hand it over to sort of forces of development.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Emma Maris, author of the book Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In your book, you speak about ways to help nature beyond walling it off in preserves and parks. And one way that involves human intervention is radical rewilding. Tell us about radical rewilding.
So this is something that I just find deeply appealing. On the one hand, it is really looking back to history, which is something that I do spend some time talking about. Maybe we shouldn't be doing so much, but the way they do it is sort of a break, because they're not looking back to 1491 or 1778 or 1850, which is often the baseline around this area. That's when the Denny Party showed up in 1851. They're looking back to 13,000 years ago before these massive extinctions I spoke of. And they're interested in restoring the ecosystem processes that went on at that time. But they have to do it without all these animals that no longer exist, so they use proxies. So the idea here is that you'd say, there's this fantastic project in the Netherlands called the Oostvaardersplassen. The ecologist in charge of that said, okay, he thinks they would have had a large herd of aurochs. These are these great, huge cattle-like animals you see in cave paintings. They're extinct now, so he brings in cattle that are bred to be as similar as possible to the extinct animals. And then he lets those run off in these huge herds. And they would have had these wild horses called tarpans. Well, they're extinct too. But he's found this line of Polish ponies that are very similar. So he's got those in there in these big herds. So he's recreating the sort of grazing regime, maybe the fire regime, the herd group dynamics. But he's doing it all with totally new, different species. So on the one hand, it's looking towards the past. On the other hand, it's making something totally new. And the result is a landscape that looks and feels incredibly wild. It's very difficult to believe that you're, you know, within walking distance of Amsterdam there, but you are. But it looks like an African savanna. It's unbelievable.
What do you see as the merits of this approach?
Well, once we move away from historical fidelity as our one be-all, end-all goal, then there's a whole bunch of other potential goals we can look at. And one thing that rewilding does is that it brings back processes rather than species. So there's a group in the United States that's interested in bringing in some animals as proxies for the ones we lost in our big extinction pulse, elephants and cheetahs and, you know, lions. So what would that project do? Well, it would be scientifically interesting. We could learn about how those ecosystems worked. It could do very interesting things to the plant communities, kind of restoring these old regimes of grazing and browsing and predation. It could also help these animals themselves. A lot of the animals that they would use as proxies are in bad shape in their home countries. Elephants suffer under a lot of poaching right now. There are not a lot of tigers and lions left, so being able to give them a new home and refuge here might be useful for the overall genetic diversity of the species. Also, it would bring back a certain amount of wildness to North America that perhaps we've lost. These animals are big and dangerous and exciting, and they certainly would be fantastic to look at.
Assisted migration is another approach to saving nature you discuss in your book. What are the arguments for and against assisted migration to help protect species that are threatened by climate change?
Assisted migration is maybe the one that just really confuses traditional conservationists the most, because they have these two kind of goals that they've been working with for a long time. One is historical fidelity, and the other one is don't let things go extinct. But if you have climate change coming and you have a species that's not going to be able to survive where it is, it's just going to get too hot, it's just going to make it miserable, it's going to die out, and you have a choice of moving it to a new location where it's never previously been found, then really you've got a choice between extinction and historical fidelity. You can't have both. You can only pick one. If you refuse to move it outside of its historical range, you'll just have to watch it go extinct. If you do move it outside of its historical range to save it, now the place that you've moved it to has a brand new species running around in it that could be arguably categorized as an exotic or even invasive. So it's a scary concept for a lot of ecologists and conservationists, but they're beginning to think that for some species, it's pretty much the only way. Some butterfly species, some small mammals. The difficulty, of course, is that it would be difficult to do it for everybody, for all the little tiny microbes and nematodes and snails and slugs. I mean, it would require a sort of a global effort. But for certain species, species of cultural importance, iconic value, it could definitely be workable. And I think, personally, that it might be our responsibility to do it.
To what extent is assisted migration currently taking place?
It's very tentative. What's interesting is that the scientists are perhaps more traditional in their outlook, are moving very slowly, but there are some citizen groups that are much more interested in it who have already moved a tree called the Florida Toria. And this is a conifer. Its sort of historical range is this teensy little area of the Florida-Georgia border, and it's just not doing well. It hasn't had new generations of trees since the 1950s. So they're moving it. They planted a whole bunch of them in North Carolina not long ago. And then what's also interesting is that when the ecologists don't really notice this because it's not happening in what they see as nature, i.e. these sort of parks and reserves, but in people's gardens, it's happening on a broad scale. There was a study in Europe that showed that gardens in Sweden now feature plants that were originally historically native to England and sort of Western Europe. So plants and animals are moving up horticulturally and in forestry, and occasionally just because people love them. But ecologists and conservationists haven't done so much of it yet because it still scares them.
Would you comment on invasive species and their threat to ecosystem health?
This is a real controversial one, and it's actually been in the news a little bit lately. There was an open letter in the journal Nature by a group of ecologists who have suggested that we may have gone a little bit overboard culturally on our despising non-native species. There are certainly species that, when they get to new places, do things that we don't like. The brown tree snake in Guam has eaten up and driven extinct a whole bunch of little birds. Now the forests of Guam are virtually silent. That's no good. Nobody likes that. However, hundreds and thousands of other plants and animals have moved around without driving anybody extinct. And in fact, extinctions that are directly due to non-native species are quite rare, much more rare than you might think. Outside of islands and lakes, which are sort of very small, closed spaces, they're virtually non-existent. The sort of terror that they were going to come and make these huge monocultures and mow over everybody else, it doesn't seem to have completely played out in that way. So there's a little bit of a backlash among ecologists about, you know, we don't have a lot of money for conservation, and if we spend all our money pulling out the common reed because it's not native to North America, when we could be spending that money turning some huge boring lawn into a nature reserve, I would go for Plan B every time.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Emma Maris, author of the book Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. One of the chapters in your book is titled Conservation Everywhere, and you cover the variety of places with conservation opportunities that aren't yet fully developed. Would you speak about opportunities for conservation on farmland?
Yeah, so farms, I remember it was so interesting to me when I was starting out on this ecology beat that the way they handle this stuff in Europe is so different than the way we handle it here, because in North America, we had the dawning of the sort of ecological ethic before we had sort of changed all of our country from what we perceived to be the wilderness condition. So we still had Yellowstone and we were able to put a wall around it. But in Europe, their ecological conservation ethic happened much later, after they had basically turned everything into a farm or a village. There wasn't much quote-unquote wilderness left. So they have a very different take on it. And one thing that they tend to do is they tend to use farms for conservation. And if you go to the website of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, they have a whole category of endangered farmland birds. The way they think of it, these birds are, quote, native to farms, and this is where they thrive. So in order to protect them, you have to run your farm in a sort of a more gentle, messy, perhaps old-fashioned way, instead of the sort of military precise rows of all one crop and heavy inputs of fertilizers and pesticides and so on. You do it in a sort of a more natural and wildlife-friendly way, and those are their nature reserves. They tend to mow them. They tend to kind of plow them and seed them and do things like that. They're practically farms. So there are all sorts of opportunities now in North America for farmers to get involved in conservation. They're probably underutilized and maybe not as well known as they should be. But the important message, I think, is that even if you are a farmer who is totally committed to what they call precision agriculture, where you get the absolute highest yield out of your land, sometimes by even using lasers to figure out exactly how much fertilizer to put on this little slope, you can still squeeze more conservation value out of your farm. You know, you could have 6-inch rows on the borders of letting them go and letting there be plants that pollinators and birds like. You could change your crop regimes. Farms are not lost spaces. There's lots of opportunities to invite smaller animals in there and to let them be used as corridors for larger animals to get from more wilder natural spaces, one to another.
Would you speak about opportunities for conservation in industrial areas, such as the Duwamish in Seattle?
Yeah, the Duwamish is a great example, and I encourage all your listeners to check out the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition offers kayak tours of the Duwamish, which is a lot of fun to get out on the river, Seattle's river, which we sometimes don't notice or seem sort of tucked away down there. But, you know, it was originally a sort of salmon river off and still is a salmon river. Then there's a long history of industrial activity on each bank. It's now a Superfund site, so the sediment is pretty contaminated. But despite that, there are salmon, there's osprey and kingfishers, and there's a sense of nature there. There's sections of the shoreline that have been restored to a more native condition. There's other sections that are sort of all blackberries and butterfly bushes, but they are still green. And then there's sections that are sort of active industrial use. And what's interesting is that the DRCC, the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition, are not arguing that the entire river should be restored to the way it looked in 1850, that we should unstraighten it, that it should go back to a pristine condition. They're arguing for a kind of a what they call an eco-industrial vision, where people can have jobs there, but they can also have nature, so that when you take your lunch break from your job at this thriving industrial location, you can watch the salmon jump, you can fish, you can get out on the river and have an experience with nature, and that they can coexist on the same short river.
What are some examples of what you call waste spaces where conservation could be applied?
So this is my own particular hobby horse. Now that I've started this project, every time I'm walking around or driving around, I see these spaces. They're sort of the interstitial spaces of the urban, suburban, peri-urban landscape. The little lawn in front of the Dairy Queen, the big sort of scrubby area behind the big box store, and the grassy area on the freeway interchange, empty lots, brown fields. You can have gas stations that are waiting for the contamination to leave so they can build something else. Parking strips would count in this category. Anywhere that's not paved and it's not being currently used, these places are all ripe for conservation. Instead of that little tiny lawn in front of the fast food restaurant, you could have a little tiny prairie, or even just a row of plants that butterflies like. There's so much opportunity. If you add up all these little tiny pieces of land, they're going to make an area much bigger than the national park system.
And what can be done by individuals in their own yards and gardens?
Well, that's what's exciting, is that hopefully, if you read the book, you can get excited about all the opportunities, and you can kind of take stock of what your own personal conservation goals are. And I argue that nearly all conservation goals can be put forward in a home garden, the exceptions being perhaps wolf conservation or something like that. But one thing that's neat about gardens is that although they're small, there are many of them, so they can act as meta populations for animals like birds or butterflies or plants. A thriving population might need a larger area than a single backyard, but if a group of people with backyards get together and they all plant the species, or they all plant plants that would attract the butterfly, then adding those gardens together can be enough area for them to maintain a little metapopulation. So, you know, ecologists have worked this all out mathematically about exactly how much space you need, exactly how far apart the yards need to be. So, yeah, you can plant a native garden, you can plant endangered species, you can plant plants that will attract animals of interest. You know, you could even do a backyard that was completely organized around carbon sequestration if you wanted to get maximum carbon in your backyard. There's tons of different things you could do. And turning it back into a little tiny slice of what Seattle looked like before Europeans came is one of those options. And I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that if that's what floats your boat.
In your book, you speak about accepting nature that looks a little more lived in than usual and working spaces that look a little wilder than we are used to. Would you elaborate?
Well, that's what I'm sort of hoping to. That's the future that I see as a positive and optimistic future, is we loosen up this mental divide between this over here is nature and there's no humans in it and it looks perfect, and this over here is not nature and we might as well just pave it. I think that we need to see these categories bleed into each other, into much more of a continuum. I'd like to see public spaces, parks, backyards look a little messier, a little wilder, more diverse. There are downsides to this, of course. We might all get more mosquito bites. You know, we might have fights with our neighbors over weedy pollen drifting over the fence. So it's not going to be necessarily easiest. And then our wildernesses, too. I mean, I think that we have to accept the fact that we're going to be meddling in them. If you look at Yellowstone, for example, already Park Service personnel are busy breeding white bark pine that might be resistant to bark beetles so that they won't lose all the white bark pine in the park. They're cutting down trees that are around living white bark pines. They won't go away in fires. This is starting to look a lot like gardening. We just haven't really accepted it yet.
What are the best overall goals to go towards in protecting nature?
That's, you know, where the rubber hits the road. I provide a sort of a list of possible goals in the book. Things like, one of my favorites is instead of focusing on species diversity, I'm interested in genetic diversity. So sometimes we'll say, okay, this species isn't extinct. There's five of them, so they're all fine. But we've lost a lot of genetic diversity within that species. So there's genetic diversity, species diversity. There might be particular species you care about, whales, elephants. You might care about ecosystem services like wetlands that filter water for people or protect against storms. You might care about recreational values, hunting, fishing, game, camping, beautiful views, beauty, spiritual values. There's a long list. The difficulty will be sorting out for any particular given piece of land which values we're going to go after. Because unlike historical fidelity, which was a one-size-fits-all goal for every piece of land, now we actually have to sit down and think about what we want out of different pieces of land, which I'm afraid means meetings and discussions and stakeholder processes and, you know, a certain amount of work. But at least in our own backyards, we can just make the decision on a personal basis. What do we care about nature other than what was here in 1850? Our goals are going to have to be personal on some level and socially shared on another level.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the message that I'd like to leave them with is this idea that nature isn't something out there really far away that you only see if you get a national parks pass or you watch Planet Earth documentary. That nature isn't as gorgeous and pristine as it's made out to be, number one. And number two, there's nature all around us, right here in the city. Street trees are nature. Backyards are nature. Seattle is a particularly diverse and beautiful natural city. The amount of bird life we have here, the amount of things going on at Green Lake or in Lake Union. Nature's all around us. We have to learn how to see that nature and cherish that nature. Otherwise, we might lose it.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Emma.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to Emma Maris, author of the book Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World, published in 2011 by Bloomsbury USA. For more information, check on the web at www.emmamaris.com. Again, that's emmamaris.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.